G.H. versus Warren Hills Board of Education. If counsel could please step forward. Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Please sit. We're going to go till around 12:30 and then break for about a half hour. We'll see how far we can get in the arguments until then. Ms. Melcher.
Good morning, Justice. May it please the court.
And try to keep your voice up if you could.
I will do my best. And I also like to please reserve some time in the beginning for some rebuttal afterwards. Thank you. The issue that's presented today is one of statutory interpretation, namely whether the amendment to the Child Sexual Abuse Act that occurred as a result of Senate Bill 477 that was signed into law by Governor Murphy in May of 2019 as Chapter 120 can be applied to acts of sexual abuse that occurred prior to the effective date of the legislation. We submit that if a proper retroactivity analysis is conducted, which did not occur in the appellate division, the answer is very clear from the language that the legislation had used that no such retroactive application to sexual abuse that occurred prior to 2019 is appropriate or intended by the legislature. Prior to Chapter 20 being initiated, the Child Sex Abuse Act allowed for passive abuser liability in situations where a person standing in loco parentis within the household knowingly permits or acquiesces in sexual abuse by any other person. It was the passive abuser liability perspective. Under that standard, based upon that language and the various cases that interpreted that language, it was held multiple times throughout the years that a public day school, such as the Warren Hills Junior Senior High School in this matter, could not be held liable under the CSIA as a passive abuser because they were not considered to be within the household. That's been a longstanding proposition and principle for at least 20 plus years. We now look to Chapter 120. Chapter 120 had made multiple changes with respect to sexual abuse victims, children and adults, including extending the statute of limitations, including a two-year look-back window, changes to the Tort Claims Act and the Charitable Immunity Act. And at issue here was Section 4 of Chapter 120 that made a change to the CSIA. Significantly, they made a substantive change. They indicated that the within-the-household provision is no longer a requirement for passive abuser liability. The impact of that is, as of December 1st, 2019, when the legislation became effect, as noted in Section 10 of Chapter 120, individuals who are now outside the household of a minor who is sexually abused has the potential to have liability for passive abusers under the CSIA. This is a legal standard that never applied before Chapter 120. Not only is this a new standard of liability, this comes with it extensive legal consequences for passive abuser liabilities, as the CSIA allows for consequential damages, attorney's fees, and punitive damages, to name a few. As such, is a significant change to the law. We know that generally laws that are prospective in nature and have effective dates, particularly in this case that were 6-7 months effective after the legislation was signed into law, they typically apply prospectively, meaning to acts that occur on or after the effective date of the legislation. In order to assess if there was any intent for retroactive application of a particular statute, it must be clearly expressed by the legislature. And in doing so, we must not look at just the language of the CSIA. We have to look at the entire language of Chapter 120 as a whole and read them together to make sense to see whether or not retroactive application was intended. In doing so, the legislature was very clear in making standards that were retroactive and other standards that were not retroactive. This is replete throughout Chapter 120, and this goes against just the general standard that when there's a new legal consequence, a new substantive change in law, you don't apply it retroactively based upon due process and fairness. There's absolutely no express intent in the language of Chapter 120 for the 2019 amendment to be applied to acts of abuse that occurred prior to that effective date. In looking at whether or not that provision should be applied retroactively, there's a two-part test that the court should imply and has implied. First, whether the legislature intended retroactive application, and second, if so, whether that application is an unconstitutional interference with vested rights or will it result in a manifest justice. Both of those must be satisfied in order for retroactivity to come into play. Under that first standard for legislative intent, this can be achieved in three circumstances: through the statutory language, the legislation's language and intent can be through direct expressly, or also through the history if we need to get that point. Also, if the amendment is curative or ameliorative, and finally, a third avenue is whether or not the parties reasonably expected there to be a retroactive application. In this situation, none of those aspects exist. Because of that, we don't even have to reach that second question of the two-part test. The main of sections of Chapter 120 applicable here are first, Section 10, as I mentioned early, which gave the future date for the effectiveness of the legislation. That alone, as our history has told us, reflects that a prospective application shall occur. Second, we have, obviously, the change in Section 4 to the CSIA. Section 4 of Chapter 120 makes no mention whatsoever that there should be any application to acts of sexual abuse that occurred prior to that effective date of December 1st, 2019. It is subject to the extended statute of limitations provision of Chapter 120, which goes to Sections 2, and also in turn with Section 9, which is the two-year look-back window. We now have to look at the language of those particular provisions to see exactly what the legislature was intending for acts of abuse that occurred prior to the effective date. When we look at Section 2, it specifically states in A1, every action at law for an injury resulting from the commission of sexual abuse as defined in Section 1 of PL 1992, Chapter 109, against a minor under the age of 18 that occurred prior to, on, or after the effective date of PL 219 C120 shall be commenced within 37 years after the minor reaches the age of majority or within 7 years from the date of reasonable discovery of the injury and its causal relationship to the act, whichever date is later.
And you're reading, from NJSA 2A:14-2A(a)(1).
Correct. That's where it was codified. And that provision is now the second aspect where we see the legislature not intending for the amended CSIA to be applied to acts that occurred prior to the effective date. And we know that because when you look at that language, the legislature specifically intended and used for the Child Sexual Abuse Act the definition of sexual abuse that existed prior to 2019 when it references sexual abuse as defined in Section 1 of PL 1992 C109. That's the prior language of sexual abuse that includes the within the household provision. Similar language is included for Section 9. To go a step further, the legislature says, you know what, we want to make sure that everyone understands which changes in standards of liability are to apply to acts that occurred prior to the effective date and which ones are occurring to acts that occur after the date. We now look to the next section of 2A:14-2A, which would be A2. That section states, to the extent applicable, any action for an injury that occurred prior to the effective date of PL 219C120 shall be subject to the provisions of subsection C of subsection 1 of PL 1959C90 and PL 2005C264 as amended by PL 219C120. Those provisions relate to the Charitable Immunity Act. That provision, the legislature specifically found the need to because of its intent for its changes made by Chapter 120 to be applied to acts of abuse that occurred prior to the effective date. Had the legislature intended for the amendatory language of the CSAA to apply to acts of sexual abuse that occurred prior to its effective date, it could have and would have included that within that subsection of 14-2A.
Does that explain why Hardwick?
Excuse me?
Is Hardwick part of that calculus?
For this, the Charitable Immunity Act?
CIA, yeah, obviously Hardwick was decided in 2006.
Yep.
It provided that the boarding school, for reasons that are given in the case, was in essence in loco parentis and was within the household.
Absolutely. The legislature wanted to put into effect and clarify essentially what I think courts had been putting into place after Hardwick based upon that decision. However, there wasn't anything similar in Hardwick with this extensive substantive change to the CSAA, and that's the difference. There's similar language to that provision that goes on within 14-2AB2, and also similarly in Section 9, which was codified at 2A:14-2B. Subsection A is very comparable to 14-2AA1, and subsection B is comparable to subsection A2 of 14-2A. When you look at that language, it was very clear what the legislature was intending, which standard changes of liability apply to acts that occur before Chapter 120 went into effect. The CSAA is not one of them.
Your argument only applies to CSAA claims against public school districts for conduct that occurred prior to December 1st, 2019, not for tort claims against public school districts for sexual abuse that occurred prior to December 1st, 2019, correct?
Correct. We're not arguing any common law torts here. This issue is specific to the applicability of the CSAA and any retroactive.
And here there were tort claims and they continue in this case, correct?
Pardon me?
Here there were tort claims brought and they continue in this case.
That is correct.
You're just making an argument specific to the CSAA.
That is very true. Though the statutory language of Chapter 120 is clear on its own, further evidence of the fact that this is not supposed to be retroactively applied is clearly delineated within the Senate Judiciary Committee statement from March 7, 2019, to Senate Bill 477. Within that initial introduction,
Make sure we're on the same page.
Yep.
Can you give us a record site to where that appears?
Yep.
At 77?
It's DA 73.
73. Begins on 73.
Yes.
But the section that you're talking about begins on 77, section 4?
I'm getting to that next.
Okay.
First on 73. right in that introductory paragraph that's on DA 73, it indicates what the Senate bill, the changes that it makes to extend statute of limitations, and then it specifically indicates the bill would also expand the categories of potential defendants in civil actions and for some actions, permit retroactive applications of standards of liability to past acts of abuse for which liability did not previously exist. The following section by section summary of the bill's provisions further details its scope and application to lawsuits that could be filed beginning on the effective date of the chapter. That particular phrase that says some actions or permitted retroactive application for standard liability clearly reflects that all of the provisions included within Chapter 120 do not apply retroactively to acts of abuse that occurred prior to the effective date. Case in point, the CSAA.
But those, that sum may refer to the type of claims that Justice Wainwright brought up before that would be non-CSAA or existing tort claims that remain active and that have the benefit of a longer statute of limitations, right? That's what that sum would be referring to.
I read it as some actions permit retroactive application of standards of liability. So it applies to the standards of liability. And those are the changed standards of liability that we're looking at in Chapter 120, which are the Charitable Immunity Act and the CSAA.
And that's because there was no, the within the household requirement as a requirement of substantive liability never applied in tort claims at all. The only change to tort claims was the TCA notice requirement no longer applying.
That is correct. And then there was also taking away that immunity for public entities.
And that sum, which may extend those standards of liability retroactively, that could be the sum that is being referred to in the financial analysis. I can't remember what the exact phrase was, where they did talk about there is going to be increased liability and that's going to be, and damages, and that's going to be one of the impacts of this legislation. That could very well be what is being referred to in that OLS analysis, right?
I think it's certainly a consideration, but I don't think when you look at what sum is modifying in this particular introductory paragraph that it refers to that fiscal impact. But I do agree that the fiscal impact certainly had application here, further to the fact that because the CSAA brings with it such extensive new legal consequences for acts that would have occurred prior to the effective date of the statute, I think the legislature recognized that. And the CSAA is not something that's specific to a public entity, whereas the Tort Claims Act is. The CSAA prior within the household provision applies to both public, private, people, organizations, entities. So it is a widespread change of law that's affected by 120. And I think part of that recognition with these additional and potentially significant damages was recognized. And that was one of the reasons why
the damages that can come only with a CSAA claim and not a common law claim.
Specifically for public entities, as the Warren Hills School District, yes. I mean, those are the punitive damages, fee shifting. They're typically not permitted in common law claims, even for the private entities.
And this is a fee shifting statute.
CSAA, absolutely.
So and that's hard to say exactly what the fiscal impact talks about, but there are a number of candidates for that designation.
Correct. And it could be very significant, particularly if you're going to look to a scenario here where the appellate division says that this new standard of liability in the CAAA, that's removing that within the household provision, can apply to acts of sexual abuse that occurred decades prior. In that setting, I think there was a balance and it was taken into consideration by the legislature when they said, you know, this is a little bit too far. We need to recognize that insurance policies and just people who are self-insured, however it may have been prior to December 1st, 2019, that's something that shouldn't be interrupted. That's something, and because it would impact the rights of people who relied upon the law at the time to subject them to additional legal consequences and liability would simply be unfair.
And that analysis that there would be, that the overarching 19 amendments would lead to increased liability and damages would exist whether the within the household amendment was retroactive or not.
It would, but it would certainly be to a much greater effect had this within the household removal from the CSAA been permitted to apply to acts of sexual abuse that occurred prior to that effective date. Because now going forward, when you have the statute out there, the law has changed as of December 1st, 2019, people can plan ahead.
So what do we make of this legislative fiscal estimate that says, quote, because of the two-year window for parties to bring previously time-barred actions, the state, school districts, and local units of government are likely to face an elevated number of claims that will have to be defended in the first few years. Each individual settlement or judgment could produce expenditures in the several hundred thousands, if not millions of dollars. School districts may be the most exposed to the filing of additional tort claims if the bill were to be enacted, given the nature of their responsibilities. It seems like they are contemplating that there could be million-dollar liability for school districts because of the nature of their responsibilities.
And I think that that was a focus, and they did recognize that because those sums can come about simply from common law claims. I think those numbers would be significantly elevated if you're in a situation where passive abuser liability is potential with fee shifting and punitive damages.
TCA plays a major role in that, obviously. The changes to the TCA.
Absolutely.
Are you relying on the last sentence of the Senate Judiciary Committee discussion of Section 4, child victims?
Yes. So that's where I was getting to next. I appreciate that. So Section 4 of the CSAA, the Senate Judiciary Committee statement, which begins on page EA-77, pretty much reiterates what I explained earlier about Sections 2 and 9 and the occurred prior to, and states, also of note, a cause of action under this section based on the expanded liability against a passive abuser, removing the household setting as a requirement for liability, is not listed in Section 2 or Section 9 concerning the retroactive application of certain newly created forms of liability to lawsuits brought under the new extended statute of limitations, or, as further detailed below, during a two-year filing window available for otherwise time-barred claims, and to see the comments of those sections, and is intended to only apply prospectively. So that language solidifies and reaffirms what is included within the legislative language itself of Chapter 120. The legislature is blatantly saying CSAA is not to apply to acts of abuse that occurred prior to the effective date. It's only to apply prospectively. We have to abide by the legislature's language. They specifically chose very specific phrases of occurred prior to, and when referencing definitions, the date of the definitions of the legislation, as well as whether or not the amended provision of that will apply or will not apply. That was purposeful.
Can I ask you to go back to the fiscal estimate for just a moment? I had another question with respect to it, because it says the bill expands categories of potential defendants in civil actions. And then it goes on to use language, once these retroactive, previously impermissible claims are adjudicated or settled, it's going to cost a lot of money, expose the state and schools to an extraordinary amount of money. That reference, is it your position that it doesn't have anything to do with the amendment here, or that it encompasses multiple categories, including it?
I think that particular phrase was specifically referencing the two-year look-back window of Section 9 of Chapter 120, when it says once these, you know, old claims are brought forth and they only had the 2 years to do that, so as of December 1st, 2021, all those old claims that would be outside of the new statute of limitations from 2A14-2A, the floodgates would be closed, is my interpretation of that fiscal statement.
And the reason that there would be floodgates again is because you could bring common law claims for abuse that had happened many years before between December 1st of 2019 and December 1st of 2021. Your argument is only that you cannot bring claims that rely on the deletion of the words within the household from the definition of sexual abuse under the CSAA during that two-year window.
That is correct. That is correct.
Generally, we don't look to legislative history unless there's an ambiguity in statutory language. And I see your argument as saying if the language of the statute is clear, but if there's any confusion, we have a very specific sentence there at the close of that section under Section 4.
Precisely.
It seems to be treating the CSAA amendment a little bit differently from a number of other things that are in the Child Victims Act.
Exactly. I think it would have been superfluous for the legislature to add those provisions into Section 2 and Section 9, indicating that the Charitable Impunity Act, as amended, would apply to those acts of abuse that occurred prior to the effective date, if everything were to be retroactive. So they put those words in purposely, and I think the intent is clear on the language itself. So yes, we don't need the legislative committee. It's just further evidence and support for what's included within the legislation itself.
I think your adversary was arguing that when the legislature enacted the CSAA originally in 1992, it used similar language that it shall not apply to any action commenced before the effective date. But then courts immediately applied it to all actions commenced after the effective date, even if the incident had happened many years earlier. What is your understanding? Did that actually happen? Were courts wrong in how they were applying the CSAA post-1992? Was it not a substantive change in liability?
Sure. So when you look at that language of the pre-Child Sexual Abuse Act, what the cases were doing, including Hardwick, which, as counsel had pointed out, was abused from the 70s, and the complaint wasn't filed until much later, until the 2001. But the fact is, the CSAA at that point had part of the statute of limitations indicating that it's based on a civil action for injury or illness on the sexual abuse. The cause of action shall accrue at the time of reasonable discovery. So this was the reasonable discovery rule that was imparted in the Child Sexual Abuse Act. And it did say that it takes effect immediately and it shall not apply to an action that's commenced before the effective date. So in that situation, when you looked at Hardwick, and in Hardwick also, I think it's interesting to note that the school waived reliance on any application of statute of limitations accruing after a certain date. So what they were doing was the discovery rule. They applied the discovery rule, and because it took effect on that date, that's why they were allowing it to occur in that regard. What I think is different...
You're saying that they were saying that the cause of action didn't accrue until many years after the abuse.
Correct, because they didn't understand the difference between the injury and the causal relationship to their damages. So that's what they were...
Who's the they here?
I'm sorry.
The people defending
the victims. The victims didn't understand the connection between the sexual abuse and their damages until much later.
And Hardwick applied within the household.
Yes. Yeah. Hardwick applied within the household. And that's part of the different nuance, is that now we have an amendment to the CSAA that is not something that one would say is curative or ameliorative. It's not designed to carry out or explain the intent of the original statute, nor is it to remedy a perceived imperfection or a misapplication of the CSAA. Instead, the change from Chapter 120 to the CSAA is altering the long-standing scope of the CSAA, and it's imparting an entirely new legal consequence, permitting passive abuser liability for claims against those who are outside the household, which never existed. It adds substantive rights.
And indeed, it's the precise way that it's accomplishing this is by deleting the words within the household from the definition of sexual abuse. So there's no argument that that is merely a procedural change, because it applies to the substantive definition of sexual abuse under the Act and nothing else. That's
absolutely
the only thing that it's changing.
Absolutely correct. And then looking at the third aspect as to when a legislature may find legislation to be applied retroactively is based upon whether or not the parties had a reasonable expectation for same. Here, there is absolutely no reasonable expectation for the parties to believe that the amended CSAA would apply to sexual abuse that occurred prior to, not only based on the longstanding jurisprudence as to application of new substantive laws to be prospective, but based upon the language of the CSAA at the time these acts occurred and the case law interpreting it, And then furthermore, based upon the fact that in this particular case, this issue has now been in litigation for almost 3 years, that alone shows that there's no reasonable expectation that anybody or the parties thought that this particular provision was to apply retroactively.
So for day schools, both private and publics, am I right about this? The distinction between the Hardwick setting, a boarding school where the alleged abuser was exerting total control over the child 24/7, including, you know, except on vacations, and a public school or a private day school, that the legislature wanted to eliminate that distinction. Is it fair to say when it took those words out?
Correct.
And it's deemed to know about Hardwick, so it's deemed to know that post-Hardwick, boarding schools were treated the same as families and extended families and people who are living in the same residence.
Absolutely.
So is that part of your argument that this was not a curative or ameliorative? And I always mispronounce that. You know the second word.
Yeah.
That particular word I have a terrible problem with. Amendment.
Absolutely. It wasn't trying to cure anything. It was specifically changing the standard of the liability. And that, you know, it doesn't apply just to day schools. The way that the CSA is currently written to remove the within the household, this could be a very temporary setting where, let's say, a babysitter takes charge of somebody, a minor, and is aware that there's sexual abuse going on and knowingly permits an acquiescence to it. So this is a very broad-reaching, substantive change in law.
That's there is still the in loco parentis boundary.
Yes. In loco parentis still applies, which if you have a babysitter for a child, you're in loco parentis, you're the one taking care of the child.
But if you're a bowling alley that has a child's league, you may not be.
You may not be. I've never thought of it in that perspective, but perhaps you're a chaperone of the minors bowling league. Now maybe you are the one in the loco parentis because other people are entrusting their children to you to watch over them for the 2 or 3 hours that they're in their bowling league. So it is a broad sweeping change of substantive law that would go against our entire history of how we apply new substantive changes in law and simply be unfair to parties who relied on that law to have new legal consequences and potential liability. And for those reasons, the appellate division decision in this matter should be reversed.
Another question. Was that Judiciary Committee report the last word on this? Because we know there were some additional aspects of legislative history.
I believe that March 7th, 2019 was the last committee statement. I believe.
And there was nothing in the governor's statement that goes to that?
Not at all. It addresses the standard liability for public entities, addressing the Tort Claims Act, and then we get into Chapter 239 that came about, which doesn't apply here because we're not dealing with the Tort Claims Act verbiage.
Other questions, anyone? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Mikosh, why don't we begin your argument? Let's see how far we can get. Hopefully we'll conclude it.
Your Honors, and may it please the Court, in this case, all tools of statutory interpretation point in the same direction, that the removal of the within-the-household requirement from the definition of sexual abuse applies only to conduct occurring on or after December 1st, 2019. Most importantly, there's clear legislative intent to apply this provision prospectively only. This is plain from the statutory text, which counsel already discussed in detail, in which the legislature gave some provisions retroactive effect, but did not include this amendment in the provisions that were providing for retroactive application. Instead, as to this provision, the legislature provided a forward-looking effective date, which our courts have repeatedly interpreted to signal prospective application. And this is reinforced by the remarkably on-point legislative history in this case in the Senate Judiciary Committee report that makes clear that this distinction that they were drawing between which provisions would apply retroactively and which would not, was intentional by the legislature, and that they only intended this particular change to the sexual abuse definition to apply prospectively to conduct on or after the act's effective date. And this is further reinforced by the presumption in cases involving substantive changes that those will be applied prospectively to conduct that happens on or after the effective date of the act. So in short, the legislative intent here is clear that this change applies only to conduct on or after Chapter 120's effective date. I'm happy to answer any questions that this court may have. Otherwise, I will conclude and ask this court to reverse the appellate division.
How does the OLS fiscal estimate factor into the analysis?
Yes, Your Honor. The fiscal estimate does discuss kind of broadly the changes that were made in Chapter 120, but the fiscal estimate is not necessarily indicating that the expanded fiscal liability that's anticipated is coming from the CSAA change specifically. As counsel noted, there are other changes that impact defendants under this law, as well, including public entities. So those other changes are also increasing the financial liability of public defendants in the state. So the fiscal estimate alone is not showing any intention for the particular change to the CSAA to apply retroactively.
Does that mean that it's hard to quantify because it applies to a number of things? Same question I asked your colleague, or that it has nothing to do with the amendment here?
Sorry, could you repeat the last?
Could it indeed be speaking to the changed amendment here?
Your Honor, I think as to claims that relate to conduct before the act's effective date, to the extent it's talking about kind of claims that are brought within this look-back window or based on prior conduct, it does seem to be referring to primarily those other provisions that are, for example, significantly limiting the immunities that are available to public entities and to charitable institutions.
And doesn't it also potentially apply to the fact that the statute is reopened for the CSAA? Claims that were obviously in a large number of claims as to which the statute of limitations had expired were being revived potentially, and that did, if I understand it correctly, include CSAA claims that may have been good claims, but as to which, you know, within the household provision or dealt with active liability as opposed to passive, but were now barred and were going to be unbarred.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct, that claims under the prior version of the CSAA, including the within the household requirement, could be part of this fiscal impact to the extent that they had been previously blocked by the much shorter statute of limitations.
So that would be, again, some sort of public residential home or something?
Yes, for example, there is a case that found a full-time youth detention facility, for example, or a full-time boarding school would fall within that. I'm not sure the number of full-time boarding schools that are public in the state, but there are public entities that were previously found to have been liable under the within the household CSAA provision.
Like Hardwick.
Yes, Hardwick is an example. I think that was a charitable entity in that case, but that is an example of one of the entities that would have fallen with in the narrower CSAA definition.
I just want to make sure that I understand. We all recognize that the two-year window has been open, and that would affect retroactive claims. The OLS document in the same paragraph speaks to previously impermissible claims. That is, claims that could not have been brought, for example, without the amendment to the within the household language. Is this reference to cost covering all of that? Or is it only covering things that are time barred and revived?
Your Honor, I think previously impermissible can refer to both things that had previously been time-barred. It can also refer to things that previously might have been blocked by the much broader immunities that were available to different entities under the prior version of the law.
TCA immunities that covered.
Yes, that's correct. And I think it's also worth noting that prospectively there is uncertain financial liability based on the broadened definition of sexual abuse in removing the within the household requirement, but that would be looking forward only to claims for conduct that occurred on or after December 1st, 2019.
So adding a little structure to the Chief Justice's question, and understanding this is a challenging question in and of itself, removing the WTH amendment issue, what would you think are the two or three most significant types of claims that are now applicable following the amendment that may feed the OLS estimate?
Your Honor, I don't have any particular types of claims that that would be available. I think in this case, for example, there were a number of common law claims brought. I can't comment on kind of the merits of those claims and whether there are any arguments that may block those claims in the future, but there are other claims that are contemplated within the
Let me ask this using the more helpful language the Justice just used. Could the WTH amendment be feeding the fiscal estimate?
Your Honor, I think to the extent it's feeding the fiscal estimate for future concerns about future liability, then yes. Of course, there will also be concerns about that, or there will also be expanded fiscal liability for future conduct that occurs on or after 2019.
But that wouldn't be here because the language specifically says once these retroactive, previously impermissible claims will have been adjudicated or settled. So the only time we're talking about previously impermissible claims are ones that are retroactive. And I think what the Chief Justice and Justice Huffman were asking were what is an example of a retroactive, previously impermissible claim that now will be adjudicated during this two-year period and could lead to liability.
Your Honor, so I think that could include, for example, if there is a CSAA claim within the household that had previously been blocked by the broader immunity provision that was subsequently amended.
And it would include, would it not, any Tort Claims Act previously immunized claim that is no longer immunized after 2019?
Yes, exactly.
Common law claims?
Yes, Your Honor. So it could include common law claims, or it could include CSAA claims within the household that would have potentially have been blocked by either the statute of limitations or kind of the broader immunities that were limited under these amendments.
It clearly would not include CIA claims because they're charitable or private. It's really
yes.
Three statutes involved. Two out of three could impact the fiscal.
Yes, that's right, Your Honor, because the fiscal estimate is only speaking to public entities.
Did you mean to say, I don't hate to make a new phrase, but did you mean to say CSAA claims outside the household? Like that, because they would be claims that were previously impermissible that would be now potentially brought prospectively. So if in 2021 you had a CSAA claim outside the household, that would be a claim that would add to damages and liability that would have been previously impermissible. So those prospective claims looking forward could have fed the estimate, right?
Your Honor, it's true that there may have been consideration for CSAA claims outside of the household based on conduct that occurred on or after December 1st, 2019. And I think in addition, CSAA claims within the household prior to that that may have been previously blocked, for example, by the statute of limitations that had been much narrower. If you're on
See, we got to three.
Yes. Thank you. If your honors have no other questions, then I ask this court to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't we take a break now and come back at around 1 o'clock.